On this week's 51%, we hear about the state of women presidents at Catholic colleges.
Those of us in leadership roles have a responsibility to educate young women today about, I think, the value and the meaning of being a president in Catholic college.
And we learn about the largest Jewish women's organization operating in the countries of the former Soviet Union. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Until the late 20th century, a women's Catholic college president was more likely to lead a college in wimple and veil than suit and tie. But as women have risen to the top job at more colleges overall, they've lost ground in Catholic higher education, their ranks dwindling as colleges went co-ed and lay leaders replaced nuns. In a church recently roiled by conflict over gender, some are worried that a bastion of female leadership is endangered. The number of women in the presidency at Catholic colleges is now at an all-time low. Sister Mary Reap is president of Elms College in Chicopee, Massachusetts, and is the exception to this trend. And she spoke with 51%'s Patrick Garrett.
Until the late 1900s, a women's Catholic college president was more likely than not to be led by a female. Now that women have started to take top jobs at colleges and universities across the country, their impact at Catholic colleges has actually decreased. So, Sister Mary, what can we actually do as a society to get more women involved in Catholic college leadership?
That's a good question, Patrick. I think a little history, when we talk about the decline in number of women, I think we need to be careful, because it is true that in the 1960s, about two-thirds of all the presidents of Catholic colleges were women, and most of those were women religious. So there was a decline that by 2003 or so, women were about 36% of the presidents at Catholic colleges, and that's even dropped a little bit more. Over the last 15 years or so, it's maintained itself at about 33% of the overall number. So on the one hand, there's been a decline. On the other, if you compare the leadership roles of women in Catholic higher education to women leadership roles, let's say in the public sector in higher education, it's about almost 10% higher. And then if you compare it to women in other leadership roles, let's say in business, we know that less than, 5% of the CEO roles in the Fortune 500s belong to women, less than 5% at the S&P belong to women. So it's all relative. I think that on the one hand, one could say there's been a decline. On the other hand, I think we would say that 33% of women in leadership roles in higher education in the Catholic sector is a pretty good percentage of women given their leadership roles in other sectors, and given the fact that we started at a very high rate early in our American history, when about 150 of the Catholic colleges actually were founded by women religious.
Do you find that there's a push for male leadership among the higher education in the Catholic institutions?
I don't know that I would say there's a push. I think what's happening is that the role of the president has shifted, or let's say the needs of the president as perceived by boards of trustees has shifted, I think, in the last several years. Many of our Catholic colleges are small. They're struggling financially. And so the board, with its fiduciary responsibilities, very often feels that they need a president with fundraising capacity and with a background in business. And so I think since, obviously, over the history of the United States, there have been many more men in business programs than women, I think perhaps it's more of trying to match the needs of the college with the qualifications of the president. And I think historically, let's say, that there have been more men in those disciplines than women. So I don't want to say it's a push toward men. I think perhaps, to a large extent, men seem to have those characteristics or qualities by way of education, perhaps more than women have had historically, although I would want to make the case that women are certainly catching up with that.
Business isn't just the only thing that universities are looking for, but as well as fundraising ability. And you've managed to raise a record $8 million for a new center on the college campus. So how would we get more women involved in fundraising in order to increase the amount of women in leadership roles in Catholic universities?
That's a good question. Again, I think culturally, most of the research and articles that you read about women in philanthropy have indicated that historically, in a married couple, the men have more or less decided where their philanthropic interests will go, to a large extent to the men's institution rather than to the woman's. I think we know that, at least with some research that has been done, that in Catholic colleges in particular, alumni have a tendency to give less to their institutions than in other sectors. So how do we get more women involved in fundraising? I think in part it's the cultural shift that is taking place beyond our campuses that will help us. I think as women emerge in more philanthropic roles, today, you know, there are more women on Catholic college campuses than there are men. And so I think that is going to help us increase the number of women in philanthropy. Second, I think it's reassuring to now know that almost half of the alumni of campuses with investable assets of $1.5 million or more are women. So I think, and I hope, as the wealth of women grows, so will their philanthropic interests. That is not to say that we, as leaders in higher education, women leaders in higher education, and particularly, I suppose, in Catholic higher education, we really need to educate our students better, both men and women, of the responsibilities that they carry to see that the next generation benefits from the type of education that they were able to have, and that without their assistance, the likelihood is that that cannot be carried forward. You know, especially in Catholic higher ed, if I may, if you think about it, as I said earlier, about 150, half of the Catholic colleges in this country were founded by women religious. And up until the 1970s, those women really did not take the salaries they were entitled to even for their congregation. Let me say that the congregations did not take their salaries as they were entitled to. Rather, for the most part, women religious congregations allowed the colleges to keep most of that salary or equivalent salary money and reinvest it into the colleges that the women founded. So there was a myth, I think, for a long time that the Catholic women's colleges or those founded by women were doing very well, and there was not a great push for students, particularly women who were the preponderance of students at those colleges, to learn philanthropic responsibilities that they had. There was a sense that the sisters ran the schools, they ran them very well, and all was well. And, you know, in the late 1990s and early 2000s, that shifted as more and more congregations required that the salaries that the sisters were earning had to go to the congregations because of the dwindling number of women entering, and they needed that to sustain the congregation. And so suddenly, the need for philanthropic support from their students increased dramatically. And I think it just takes time for reality to catch up with the understanding that today the need for students, alumni of our Catholic colleges to give back is really an extremely important aspect of what we have to help our students understand. It takes time to change a culture, I think.
Yeah. What do you think an average person who would be on the campus could do to help increase the women's roles in the higher ed?
Well, people on campus can certainly provide, as we try to do here at College of Our Lady of the Elms and on most college campuses, leadership programs for our students. You know, a lot of our students at our Catholic colleges were first generation college students, the first in their families. Today at our college and many like us, more than 65% of our students are still the first in their families to graduate from college. And so the aspirations of first generation students often are to get a good job and to do better than those in their families before them. But I think those of us on campuses can help them to dream big and to understand that they really can reach the high levels, and that the opportunity to become a president of a Catholic college in particular really allows them to live out their faith and to help the next generation grow in that faith in a very particular and fulfilling way. So I think those of us in leadership roles have a responsibility to educate young women today about, I think, the value and the meaning of being a president in Catholic college, and to help them then develop the career track that will lead them on the way to fulfill that aspiration.
Why do you think a Catholic higher education is important to us today?
You know, I think it's extremely important. I think our society is in a critical state, isn't it, when the sense of ethics and values and the very critical ethical and value-based decisions that people are faced with today are extremely complex, and where I believe that for this generation of young people in particular, they do not seem to have grown up with the same basis of faith that many of us in earlier generations did grow up with. So I think today that being on the campus, whether you're Catholic or not, if you're on a religiously affiliated campus, I just think the whole ethos of that campus environment, where ethics are dealt with, where value-centered education is presented, where one has the ideal of trying to educate the whole person, not just for a career, but for a good life. I think the philosophy and mission of a Catholic college is very relevant to the needs that this generation of young people, not only do they need it, but I think they're very hungry for it. And they find it, I think, on campuses like ours. I think that today young people are very hungry for a life of integrity, and I think our Catholic college campuses, or all religiously affiliated campuses, really provide them with the opportunity to explore the kind of human being that they really want to be and what the core values of their life will be as they enter into their career paths.
And then finally, the Catholic hierarchy on a international level has historically always been men, such as the Pope. Not calling for the Pope to change, but would you say that overall the hierarchy does need to see a change?
Well, I would think most of people who have an opinion on this would hope that there would be more inclusion of women at leadership roles at the international level. I would say, however, that there has been a major shift in the recognition and inclusion of women, I think, in some very major positions. I think that the fact that there are three women leading probably the three largest agencies of the Catholic Church at this time, Catholic Relief Services, Catholic Charities, and the Catholic Hospital System, I think speak to the shift that is taking place among recognition of women in leadership roles. I think women have always had a leadership role in education and in higher education, as we've talked about during this interview. And I think at a parish level, I think we see women taking on the preponderance of leadership roles in pastoral ministry and in other roles in their parishes. So I think I think there is a shift taking place. I think when we talk about leadership roles for women, people really are referring to ordination or perhaps higher leadership roles within the Vatican. And I think that will require a cultural change, and it takes a great deal of time to change an institution at those levels, although I think that this Holy Father has spoken eloquently to the inclusion of women, and I believe that some of those changes are taking place, but I think more importantly, throughout the Church, we see that role shifting and much more inclusion of women at very meaningful leadership roles. So I'm optimistic that it will take place at all levels eventually.
Well, I want to thank you, Sister Mary, for talking with us today on 51%.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Patrick. I've enjoyed talking with you.
That was 51%'s Patrick Garrett speaking with Sister Mary Reap, president of Elms College in Chicopee, Massachusetts. Now we bring you another installment of the 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California. She regularly blogs for the Huffington Post, and this week she interviews Karen Gershon, executive director of Project Kesher, a network of Jewish women's organizations and interfaith women's coalitions operating in more than 200 communities in Belarus, Georgia, Moldova, Russia, and Ukraine, and more recently, Israel. Project Kesher promotes Jewish identity building as well as social activism on issues including computer and economic literacy, tolerance, domestic violence, trafficking, and women's health issues. Project Kesher has trained more than 3,500 women leaders in their region who conduct more than 4,500 programs each year to promote gender equality and create more peaceful societies. Ufberg asked Gershon, who is based in New York, to share more about the network.
Project Kesher is able to operate the way it does because it really only invests in three things. The first is leadership training of women. The second is posting programs every month on the internet that women can download, culturally adapt, and then run in their communities. And third, mentoring by other women to help them with their programming. There are always women who are more senior in the network who can help them move ahead and accomplish what they need to in their communities. I think that the way that we've been most effective in operating over such a wide geographic region is because we invested early on in developing trust among the women. When women sit in large circles and talk to each other and really bare their souls and talk about the things that are most important to us, we're able to really develop shared values. And once we have shared values, we're very comfortable releasing power into the network so that women can do what they find most important in their communities. Once the women take on ownership of what they prioritize, it's really very easy not to look back and to just watch as they accomplish what they feel their communities need.
You know, it's so interesting. It's really truly the essence of grassroots organizing. And I think as women, we do this so well. You know, there isn't a huge hierarchy that's developed. And over the course of time, I know that you've spent, you know, almost 20 years at this helm. And I'm wondering, you know, is it still as relevant today as it was when you started? Are the needs very different? And perhaps you can just give us a few examples of the kinds of things that these women's groups actually are doing on the ground.
I think that what has happened over a period of 20 years is that as the relationships have deepened among women within the region and internationally, we're able to work deeper and deeper into the types of issues that we can address. So early on, we were able to talk about some very simple things. We were able to work on issues like what it had been like during the communist era when no forms of religion could be practiced, and that now there was a reemergence of religion. We were able to talk about the fact that women needed to get over taboos, such as even talking about domestic violence and even talking about trafficking in women, things that everybody knew were issues in the region, but they really weren't willing to discuss openly. Today, now that we're really very close, we talk to each other all the time about issues about our lives. For instance, I was with a young woman I had met when she was about 13 years old at a mother-daughter retreat. We feel very strongly that women's leadership runs intergenerationally. Well, now she was a Project Pesher employee, and all of a sudden I'm talking to her about her newborn baby, and I asked how it had gone, and she said, well, she had suffered from bad mother's disease. And in that moment, I knew that they didn't have good vocabulary around issues like postpartum depression. Well, in order to make social change, the first thing you have to be able to do is name the problem. And if you don't have vocabulary, you can't name it. So you have to step back and look at it, name the problem, and then talk about the different strategies for addressing it. And today, we have many women who will come to Project Hesher specifically so that they can talk about issues in their lives in an environment that is safe when most other places they're not ready to discuss them. This has come up again with issues like breast cancer. There's a taboo in the region to even talk about breast, and we were wondering why so many women would go so long that they could even feel a lump in their breast, but they wouldn't go to the doctor. And then we discovered that the women had this perception that if they had been diagnosed and treated, God forbid they had to have a mastectomy, they didn't feel that they would still have a status as a woman in their community, much less in their marriage. And we had to work really hard with a group of women to figure out how they could start culturally appropriately talking about the fact that they were more than their breasts. So I think that the work remains very relevant 20 years later, in particular because we're able to talk about so many more meaningful things that are really so personal to these women and to us.
I think it's so beautiful to see not only in this age where everything is, you know, can be virtual and that you span seven time zones, so you could, in fact, never meet in person, that this community of women still finds it very valuable to meet together, to gather as women, to support one another, and whether it's, you know, keeping heat on in a community building, in a school, whether it's doing big interfaith coalition work around the issues of trafficking or domestic violence, that you do still maintain that importance of women gathering and women, you know, activating their own power in whatever way they see fit.
I think some of the most exciting things happening at Project Hesher are unfortunately based around the fact that there has been so much tension in that region in the last couple of years. In particular, the women have been very active in helping to try to stabilize eastern Ukraine. There are more than 1.5 million displaced people right now in Ukraine, and the women are really using very basic but very powerful methods to get clothing, toys, food out to communities where people are living in transition. They've also been very successful in bringing in medication from outside of Ukraine and actually smuggling it into the contested areas. They've also been very effective in going into Crimea, which is a very controversial area at this time. It had been annexed by Russia, but that annexation is not being recognized by everyone because it's really outside the bounds of normal diplomacy. And so Project Hesher was able to send in women to work in Crimea to ensure that people who needed new passports and needed to convert over to the Russian currency and economy were able to do so.
Thank you so much. Karen Gershon from Project Hesher. This is Dr. Sharon Usford on Force of Nature for 51%.
For more information on Project Hesher, visit projecthesher.org. Wisconsin-based retailer Land's End is apologizing to customers for featuring feminist Gloria Steinem in its spring catalog and has removed her from its website. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that the company has removed a feature on Steinem from its website after customers complained about her support for abortion rights. It issued an apology to customers who were offended. Steinem had been interviewed by company CEO Federica Marchioni for the Land's End Legend series. The company says in a statement that its goal was to feature people who have made a difference and not to take a political or religious stance. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1390.